Welcome to the Mere and Powerful podcast, where we believe in going far by going together. Welcome, everybody, to the Mere and Powerful podcast. On this episode, I sit down with Blue Bottle founder James Freeman in their brand new Seoul Korea Cafe, and it is beautiful, let me tell you. Blue Bottle does it right. When they open up new cafes in new countries, it is a sight to see. I flew over there a few days early, got to hang out with the team, which was a huge honor. We partner with Blue Bottle. We do all of their reusable drinkware for them in merchandise, and it is extremely popular, especially over in Asia. So I had the unique opportunity to be there and sit down in the cafe and ask James a whole host of questions and really kind of dig into his mindset and how he thinks about the world and design and why he started Blue Bottle and what he's up to now. I enjoyed the conversation. I hope you do as well. And if you happen to be in Korea, you should stop by their new cafe in Seoul. It is a sight to be seen, and there are lines out the door almost every day. So it is worth checking out if you are in Korea. Without further ado, my conversation with James Freeman. Welcome to the Empowerful Podcast, James.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's good to have you on the show. We are sitting here in Seoul, Korea.
Yes.
The day before your grand opening in Seoul, which is really exciting.
Yes, yes, yes. It's been fun seeing the space take shape, seeing the team take shape. I think it'll be a nice opening.
Yeah, so we've, many times that we've had people on the guest, to provide context for our listeners, Mere and Blue Bottle have partnered together. We do the stainless steel insulated travel drinkware. We've done a couple partnerships in Ethiopia. Charlie, your coffee grower, our green buyer, has actually been to the school where we've helped put in clean water.
That's right.
Which has helped provide over 1,100 kids with access to clean water, which is really cool. So,
yeah.
Thank you for your partnership and being able to contribute to the greater world.
It's been great. It's been great seeing your stuff on our shelves. It's been a nice collaboration.
I think one of my favorite moments, before we hit record, James and I were talking about Patagonia and such an incredible relationship. And we've been working in Korea with Patagonia for the past few years. And I think looking back on my journey as a founder and businessman, I'm always kind of humbled and blown away. Patagonia reached out through our help desk, as well as Blue Bottle. It was a bit unique. I think it was Saki at the time had reached out and said, "We love your design. We love your aesthetic." We met at SCA.
Right. I remember her telling me, and I never go to SCAs, but she was talking like, I asked her, "What did you see at SCA? Anything interesting?" And she said, "Well, not really, except there are one or two things, and I want to show you these cups." And like, "Oh, all right."
That's awesome.
So
I'm appreciative of you all for your attention to detail and quality, and it's been good to partner with you all. I think one of my favorite moments of our partnership was in Japan with Rio, and I was just sitting there enjoying a nice pour over, and I saw some tourists come in and literally probably purchased 10 or 20 reusable cups. And I walked over there and I tried to explain them in broken Japanese and English, that was my company. And they were so excited. And we took a selfie, and it was quite a surreal experience.
People like to buy the merchandise in our stores.
They do.
Especially in Asia.
Yep. They do. It's fascinating. I'd love to, I've heard a couple stories about you loving coffee from your parents, opening that can, using that can opener at a very early age. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Northern California, Humboldt County, where the giant redwoods are.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful country.
It is a red state and a blue state. Yep.
So have you stayed there throughout your entire life?
I grew up there, and then I was eager to leave, which I did at age 16, and then I've been back for small amounts of time since then.
Were you an only child, or did you have siblings?
I had two older sisters, 11 and 13 years older than I was, so it seemed, they were... very important to me, but they were kind of more parental than siblings.
Yeah, interesting. I grew up with three older sisters.
Oh, it's good.
So yeah. I think it's helped a lot in my career.
Yeah. I mean, just being in business, being an employee. I think growing up with sisters what's the good way to say it? I think it's helpful for a man in the business world to grow up with sisters. Because one tends to treat women like humans.
Yes.
And unfortunately, in the business world, that's not incredibly common.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so I think it would be nicer if more CEOs had older sisters.
Yeah, that's a good observation. I couldn't agree more. I remember hearing about my sister applying for a job, and she was talking about how she was going to get paid less because she was a woman, and it like kind of blew my mind. Because growing up with them, they're much smarter than me. One of my sisters went to Stanford, and one's a doctor, and they're incredibly accomplished. And I just remember being like, "Well, wait, how could that be? That seems odd to me." And so, I'm a big fan of my sisters, and then obviously women in business can do incredible things, and the business results are crazy. You know, just in general, there should be equity, but I love that there's also a business case for women in business as well. So, in your journey, where did you go from Humboldt? Did you go off to college? Were you into music?
I bounced around a little bit. I ended up studying with a clarinet teacher. He played in the Boston Symphony from 1933 to 1966. His name was Rosario Matzeo. He had retired in 66 to Carmel. He was an avid photographer, a serious photographer, and he knew Ansel Adams. He wanted to go out to study with some photographers there, and he was a well-known clarinet teacher. He took me on as a student, and so I studied with him and worked very hard, and I went to UC Santa Cruz just because it was near Carmel. I wanted to get a bachelor's degree in something. I wasn't interested in academic music. I was focused as a performer, but I wasn't interested in academic music, so I majored in philosophy there, and I'm glad I did.
Yeah, it seems like it served you well and kind of your outlook in life. And
Yeah.
And so then I'm so fascinated that you went into, I mean, you were at an orchestra, you were playing at a high level. Mm. Is there like first chair clarinet? I know with like violin and some others, there's like first chair, second chair.
Yeah, I was freelance. So I did, had a wide variety of things that I did in music. I played in small ensembles. I played with quintet that toured around, played in different orchestras, first or second or bass clarinet or E flat clarinet, if that's the little one. Opera company, so it was a lot of different types of performing, which, you know, I look back on it and it's like it was interesting to have that variety.
Yeah, so I know that you said that you were in some of other interviews that you went through this kind of reflection period of not necessarily being satisfied with, you know, where you'd gone. You were in this like absolute pursuit of perfection with music, and that there was just kind of this moment or evolving moment where you were baking the classic stories. You were baking coffee beans in your perforated baking sheet in your house. And walk us through that. What was that like to kind of have that experience and then to do something about it?
Yeah, it was well timed. You know, at the time that I was being more and more fascinated with coffee. There literally in San Francisco was not a place where you could go to get a bag of coffee with a roast date on it.
Yeah. Right?
And this idea of coffee being fresh food was very meaningful to me and the taste of coffee. And I felt like that was an incredible opportunity, but it was very compelling. It's like I wanted to be able to share that with people, like that coffee is delicious at a certain time. Yeah. In its life after being roasted, and it gets less delicious after that time. And it's like, why don't people know that? I was a farmer's market shopper, so I understood that model of commerce. I thought I understood that model of commerce. It was a pretty simple model. And also that idea of freshness, the idea of California cuisine, that was the heart of it, the Ferry Plaza farmer's market, right? So
what were you drinking at the time? Was it Pete's that you were drinking at the
time?
Yeah,
a lot of Pete's coffee, which I liked at the time. You know, I would look around for different coffees, and then I just started roasting my own, and I really liked it. I thought that was really delicious.
Yeah.
A very crude way to roast coffee, but
I, like you, when you were 3-4, open that can and experiencing the smell of coffee, I was always confused about the disconnect between the great smell of coffee and the horrible taste of coffee.
Right, right. That's compelling.
Yeah, my grandparents who grew up in Oakland, who are still there, they essentially raised my mother and myself on Chemex. We would go to North Star
in
the cabin, and it was
cool.
Just always Pete's over Chemex. And
it's,
I remember my mom, we lived in Portland for a while. My mom would go to Starbucks and buy coffee. And this is when Starbucks was actually getting their coffee roasted by Pete's.
Right, right.
Which a lot of people
early
know about.
Days. Yeah.
But again, there was always this weird disconnect of, I love the smell. and then just the taste wasn't quite there.
Yeah.
So that's great. So you started just roasting on your own. I'm so fascinated by your... Have you been able to pinpoint anything in your life as far as being able to move from that idea of, I think I'm going to roast coffee, I think I'm going to do this farmer's market thing? Because a lot of people who are unhappy, I think it's 70% or 80% of Americans aren't satisfied with their jobs, and yet they don't do anything about it. You know, so you were a little unhappy with clarinet playing, and yet you did something about it. Do you know why or how that kind of came about? Or just,
I don't know. I mean, what it's, I guess I wasn't very comfortable. It's easy to be unhappy, kind of unhappy, but if you're, you know, making a certain amount of money, then you feel like it's hard to leave, like the risks aren't worth it. I wasn't making a ton of money or had a very comfortable life as a musician. So it didn't seem like that hard.
So the risk was somewhat
leave
low.
It behind. Yeah. I think it helps to be unhappy. It helps to be uncomfortable.
Yeah, that
so
piece of uncomfortability kind of pushed you towards starting something new.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And you opened up your first kind of back alley cafe roastery in Hayes Valley.
The roastery was not in Hayes Valley. The little kiosk was in Hayes Valley, 2005.
Oh, the kiosk was, okay.
It's still there on Linden Street.
Oh, that was your first store,
right?
That
was the first 7-day-a-week store. Yeah. I had done farmers markets for a few years before, and the roastery was in a little place behind the restaurant Doña Tomas in Temescal District of Oakland.
Yeah. Do you, I know that there's a story about how you had kind of two credit cards and you kind of max them out to kind of get going. I had a similar story of the bank wouldn't give us a line. I had four
bank
credit cards maxed out.
Yeah. I don't know who they give money to, but they will never give you
question.
A loan.
And people are like, well, you were crazy. You took out four credit cards and maxed them. And looking back, I don't remember kind of thinking it was crazy. Did you have a similar experience?
Yeah. Like people say a lot of things, right? Like, and you can pay attention or you not pay attention, but generally it's better not to pay attention, you know? So you have this compelling idea that you're so focused on that you just do what you do to make it happen.
Yeah. And so the name, when you kind of went into this, how, I know there's, you know, you were looking at cafe culture in Europe and Blue Bottle kind of came about through that. What was kind of the aha moment of, you know, I think this is going to work for a name and a logo. I know you traded a bag of coffee or something for.
Oh yeah. There was no aha moment. I like had this idea of Blue Bottle. I read about it. It's like, okay, that's, you know, if I can't think of anything better, then I'll do that. And I couldn't think of anything better. So it's like, all right, I don't know how I feel about this name, but I'll do it anyway. My mother was deeply skeptical of that because Blue Bottle is a fly in Great Britain. She's Irish. And so it's a type of a fly. So she thought it was a horrible idea. And generally it's good to do things your mother thinks are a horrible idea, right?
Yeah, that is some wise advice. My grandmother the other day, we were having brunch and she had asked me, she goes, you know, Brian, are you still, you know, majority owner of your company? And I said, I am. And she goes, well, so you can change your name. I was like, well, I guess I could. And she went down this whole rabbit hole of how Mir didn't have the staccato of her husband had started the Pape group and heavy machinery and kind of Pape the staccato. Oh. And she does Toastmasters and she's an incredible woman. And she's like, I've been thinking about this a lot, and I think you should change your name to Bricor. And I was like, all right, Baba, as we call her, I appreciate the feedback. You know, we have this website and these trademarks, you know, it's kind of hard to change the name. But the thing I really appreciate about your logo, and I think you've mentioned this, is that it is what you say it is, in the sense that your logo is a blue bottle, right?
And
your name
is
Blue Bottle. And, you know, with Mir, the thing that I liked was this duality of the two eyes, you know, that kind of mirrored each other, and that, you know, product to project, one person helping another. And so this kind of beauty of simplicity has evolved, especially with you all, where you had the blue bottle over the text, and then you had that great idea to kind of strip that away and have this iconic logo. And now that's what people look for their cafes.
Yeah, I totally just got lucky about that logo. This woman, Oksana Davina, who's now head of design at Ghirardelli, I think. I've stayed in touch with her. She calls it her good luck charm because everybody, like her portfolio when she was like getting jobs after that, people were like, I love that logo. So she came up with, I remember very distinctly, she was the only graphic designer I knew. She was married to a friend of mine that I played music with, and she agreed to do a logo for me, and she gave me a lot of comps, like maybe 30 different versions.
Oh wow.
And they were, you know, all interesting in their way, But my constraint was I had to stamp a bag, a coffee bag with the logo on it. So what does that constraint mean? It has to be pretty simple. You know, it can't be very intricate, can't have a lot going on. So that constraint actually was great design constraints. Like, what can you stamp on a coffee bag? It's like very simple things. It has to be one color. You know, it has to be very simple shapes. So there was that bottle in it. And as you mentioned, the text was over it. And I did that for the first couple of years. And then I had this idea of just, I like the bottle, and just like getting the bottle out, having it be a glyph, really, a sign rather than a logo.
Yeah.
And that's all we needed.
It's beautiful. Especially on the cement wall with the blue, it's so striking. Our Pantones are one off. Yours is 2995C.
Yeah.
Ours is 298C.
Oh, how funny.
Our factories are very frustrated by the fact. They're like, why can't it be one? I'm like, because Blue Bottle has theirs and yep. we have ours. And it's a
different world.
It's a different world. But I definitely appreciate that. I love this idea of constraints and how innovation and great design can come from constraints.
Oh, yeah. Art is about constraints.
That's yeah. for sure. Walk us through some of the early constraints of, you know, you only had two credit cards. You had this kind of mindset of farmers markets. What were some of the constraints that, looking back, you were like, wow, this was really beneficial for us as a business?
It's, you know, being very, very small. I mean, all of the constraints that I didn't really appreciate, constraints around how much work I could do in a given day, constraints around batch size, constraints around how many drinks I could serve, constraints around square footage, you know, all of that. Like, you know, we started out, it was my taste anyway, but we started out with no different sizes, no flavors. This coffee is a flavor. And a lot of that simplicity is just like, I didn't want to manage all the different cups at the farmer's market, small, medium, large. You know, I had this much space at the farmer's market. So it's like, okay, cappuccino is going to be cappuccino size. There's not going to be like the idea of a large or a small cappuccino. It didn't make sense to me anyway. And I didn't have room for all the extra cups, and similarly with latte. So, you know, like all of those early moves towards simplicity in my menu, that was how I was inclined to live, but also there was just no room for stuff at the market.
How do you keep that attention to constraint or simplicity, in the sense that you've scaled beautifully across the world, you've improved? I'll never forget, we went to a trade show in 2012, and we were 2 years old, and I had this idea that because I'd kind of grown up on drip, and it took about 3 to 5 minutes to make, and I thought, you know, at trade shows, there's always horrible coffee. Mm. So we're going to have a pour-over bar at our trade show booth. We were trying to get the attention of REI at the time.
Oh, that's cool.
And so I brought my mom, and she did pour-over coffees at my booth at our first trade show.
That's charming. That's really good.
And we had 3 minutes, you know, just to make this cup of coffee. And of course, REI came by, oh, good coffee, you're from Seattle, you know, and it was all planned. And it worked out. And we had this time period of 3 minutes to kind of tell our story and who we were and what we were doing. And I'll never forget, so many people were like, oh, if you guys do this big batch thing, you can serve more people and more coffee. And I go, that's not the point. The point is to have a conversation,
to get to know
somebody. And I'm always fascinated by this pressure to scale. And there's good things about scale and growth. Mm. And yet, we'll never change that. It's always been in our booth of good pour over coffee and this conversation.
Nice. Yeah,
so
yeah.
Is there anything that's, you know, any examples that stick out to you where, you know, there's been this push to like remove the constraints and do more sizes? Oh, James, if you had a 16 ounce latte, you'd sell a ton of them or whatever else. And how have you stuck to your
I mean, that's part of it. There are, in Blue Bottle now, people want to push on those constraints that have served us well. It's not for me to decide whether they do them, so we'll see how that goes. I tend to think the simplicity that got us here is going to be our greatest strength, but some people want to try different things, and you know, it's good to try different things, I suppose. So but I do like, I think coffee is most delicious when it's made one cup at a time, and it perhaps always will be. That's something we'll see. But yeah, those early constraints are very powerful, you know, simplicity and dedication towards quality. The symbolism of people seeing that pour over bar and people making one cup very carefully, attentively for one guest, I think is very powerful. It sends a powerful message.
Yeah, and it's a very unique approach, and I think you had mentioned this.
Is it, though? I mean, you know, well, people have been making coffee one cup at a time like that in Japanese cafes since the 1920s.
For sure. So in certain cultures, it's been unique. I think in American culture, it's not been unique.
Yeah.
I mean, Phil's has a lot of pour over. You know, the current, this mass, how fast, what's your bar flow rate? How fast can you get these things out batch? You know, and for you, it was kind of a unique approach in the sense that the pour over bar simplicity was not necessarily in the U.S.
People thought we were freaks. Like at the farmer's market, people saw us like a little jiggity set up and making one cup at a time and the lines and the weight and just thought we were freaks. Maybe they were right.
Maybe not, though.
Yeah. Who's the freak now,
who's
man?
The freak? Well, I love how that approach of you keeping it simple has allowed you to, in a sense, have good success. Whereas, you know, if you would have listened or done, you know, quote unquote market research, I think I'm on the same page as you as far as market research. If I'd asked people what they wanted a cup, they would just say, I just want a bigger cup or a whatever cup. They would have bought a vacuum insulated, easy to hold, studied the hands of why it feels good in their hands, so early on, if you would have done market research, people would want it. Oh, I want a hot 16-ounce latte or batch brew or
they wanted sizes and French roast and flavors and all that kind of stuff. Didn't want to wait as long, didn't want to pay as much.
And you've kind of gone against the odds and done a little bit differently.
Yeah.
How do you balance that duality of you know, oftentimes specialty coffee is a little bit lighter roast, it's not too overdeveloped or roasty, and yet you do have, you know, Bella Donovan's a little bit more developed, and so how have you been able to kind of balance those preferences
in specialty coffee? I've always liked to have a variety of tastes on the menu. I think a variety of tastes on the menu is nicer for a guest coming in. It's a nicer experience to have that variety, and that's what I like to see, a variety of tastes. So that from the very beginning, that's been important to me, having this variety. You know, even on the espresso menu, we've got Hayes Valley, which is very thick, kind of old school, chocolatey espresso, and then we've got a more layered, lighter roasted, more fruit forward, single origin espresso. That's, I think, in all of our shops, we have that.
Is it an Ethiopian or?
It depends. It's seasonal.
Okay, seasonal.
So sometimes it's a wash from Central America, sometimes a dry process, you know, but it's generally served in even a bigger cup, more water pushed through it, definitely more delicate, more layered.
Yeah. So on the flavor piece, I'm curious, I feel like wine and beer, even spirits a little bit, is a little bit ahead. I mean, food's way out there, but it's almost, people are kind of understanding the seasonality of fresh hop IPAs and this and that. And I'm curious as to why coffee, I mean, it's becoming more culinary for sure. Seasonality, people understand that Burundis are seasonal and there's different seasons for flavors and different roast profiles. Do you have any thoughts as to why coffee seems to be trailing so far behind, and maybe I'm wrong, but behind food and beer and some of these other agricultural products?
Yeah, coffee's been a commodity for a very long time. So there's these entrenched ways of thinking about what coffee should be worth, what coffee should cost. I also think, you know, there's this imperial quality to people's thinking about food still. It's like if coffee was grown by white dudes that lived in the United States, people would be more willing to have conversations about its value. And, you know, traditionally coffee's been grown in places where people have been impoverished for many, many generations. And I think there's less inclination amongst the Western public to want to engage with those people.
To not even know who is behind the
cup. Yeah, or I mean, it's convenient not to know or care because then you can talk about how you want cheap coffee.
Yeah, the I think the movement, you know, ironically, you know, people love to hate on Starbucks and some others. I do think Starbucks has done a great job sustainability.
We're here
and
talking because of Starbucks.
Absolutely.
Starbucks created a market. My kids go to good school because of Howard Schultz.
Yeah. We actually made the first bicycle for Starbucks when they opened their first roastery in Seattle, which is a fun random fact. But they've done such a good job in sustainability. We've gotten to know them in Seattle and they're doing some amazing things around blockchain and traceability, and they're so passionate about
that. That's really cool.
And I'm hoping that they succeed because I think others will follow in their footsteps.
That will set the terms for the industry.
Exactly. So there's a lot of good. So even though I don't necessarily want a 16-ounce Frappuccino. I think they are doing some good things in the sustainability side. Let's talk about sustainability. How do you approach it? I know you kind of broke out Blue Bottle into three things when you're training. It's it's deliciousness,
hospitality and sustainability.
On the sustainability piece, what does that look like for Blue Bottle?
That's been harder to quantify. I mean, very early on, we were among the first coffee companies, multi-unit coffee companies, that switched to PLA-lined cups and PLA lids. I mean, PLA isn't a perfect material. It's still made from corn, GMO corn, but at least it was supporting an industry. I remember a long time ago, back when I used to sign all the checks, the first month that we spent more than $1,000 on compostable trash can liners.
Really? Like, wow.
Really, $1,000 on trash can liners? Even though some of those were in New York and they were going right into a landfill, for me, it was always like, okay, even though these waste chains aren't perfect, if we can support an industry that's trying to make a difference, then that's worth investing in.
Sure.
Compostable trash can liners and that.
Which could break down in a landfill in theory, so it's better than a big black thick bag.
Yeah, and it's not petroleum based.
Exactly.
So those kinds of steps, using organic milk where possible, where it was also very delicious. In the organic certification standards for Japan are very stringent, and so we've had less success getting organic certified products that meet our standard for deliciousness, both with coffee and with milk. But just looking where we can, we recently switched from the very charming blue PLA straws that we have been using to paper straws in the United States. And as soon as we're done with our inventory of PLA straws here, we'll switch to paper straws. Paper straw, I mean, that's a hospitality trade-off. Paper straws are not as good an experience as a coffee drinker, especially in humid climates. But we would all prefer that people drink things for here, but if they're going to take them away, then paper straw, I think, is what we ought to do, because the PLA straws will, in an anaerobic environment, will take very, very long time to
break down. They're not properly composted.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're probably aware of this in Korea. I do think this is an admirable move by the Korean government. Korea has been known for one of the highest per capita users of single serving plastics.
Oh, wow.
It's been awful in the sense of their rise from the Korean War to now, and a lot of wealth, a lot of generation. The waste has become a huge issue for them, and Patagonia has been very instrumental in helping. And a recent law was passed where a cafe can be fined if I came in and said, oh, I'll have this for here, but I'd like it to go cup.
Oh, that's cool.
If you're in the cafe, I don't know who polices this. I don't think it's the actual police.
Exactly. There's not a guy with a badge at the POS.
Yeah.
So it sounds like symbolic, but symbolic laws are powerful too.
It'd be interesting to see what the actual effect is, but I thought that was an interesting concept, because oftentimes people come in and say, oh, no, I prefer it in a paper cup. And you're like, really? Like, for here? Let's not do that. And I think it's great that Korea's actually like starting a movement of, hey, we're going to try to take a stance against single-use plastics. If you're going to enjoy a beverage in the cafe, it needs to be in a ceramic or stainless or some sort of vessel that's for here.
That's great.
So I think that's a great step.
Yeah, I was not aware of that.
Yeah, we our distributor here had kind of kept us informed on the laws, and Patagonia Korea had made this.
It's good for you, too.
It's great for us. It's great for business. They made this really fun video where they kind of do this Korean-style handshake with the mugs, and they got a K-pop star involved, and I'll have to show you the video. It's pretty funny.
Cool.
On the hospitality side, I'm curious how you've been able to scale in really busy cities without doing batch brew and just being confident in the preparation method. Has that just been is that part training? Is it part just culture?
Yeah, we have very, I think we have very skilled training departments that are everybody that comes through, even if they work in the office, will go through the training, coffee making training, hospitality training. That's a tricky bit of explanation. It's like, no, you can't have your coffee right now.
Yeah.
Part of that is about the design of the shops. There's one reason, or one of the reasons, that the drip bars are so prominent is that, like, creates this, like, okay, that's where my coffee comes from, and I might have to wait a bit. In point of fact, Blue Bottle is testing out batch brew in a couple places in New York. just to see if that makes people happier.
Yeah, interesting. Because there's the pace and the line there is real.
Right. Yeah.
There's
but I don't know. I am interested to see how those experiments work. Quite often, I think people say they want certain things, but I'm not exactly sure what customers say they want, they actually want.
It's like Henry Ford. He would have said, "What do you want?" They said, "A faster horse."
Right.
You built the car instead.
Yeah.
I read a quote by you. They said, "Good design is the absence of obstacles." Which I think is beautiful. I didn't go to design school, but I do a lot of our product design, and I've looked up to Dieter Rams and this idea.
Did you see that documentary?
Yeah.
Just came out? That's so beautiful. Less but better.
Less but better. Good design is as little as possible. So now we have designers on staff who are much better at CAD than I am, and we'll come up with something, and I'm like, that's great, but less.
Right.
This idea, and I love this idea that when there's less, it has to be better. You can't hide behind, especially with coffee, you can't hide behind hazelnut syrups or other things, sweeteners, to make the horribly roasted coffee taste better.
Right.
Has good design and that intentionality always been part of your life, or how did that kind of become a philosophy of yours?
Yeah, I think it goes back to my career as a musician. You know, every utterance, every moment was deeply considered, and the act of learning how to be a better instrumentalist is primarily a subtractive one. Like nipping away all the things that you don't realize you're doing, all the habits that are getting in your way. The additive advice can be pretty easy and pretty simple and straightforward, but the subtractive stuff, your teacher being right next to you when you're playing something, it's like, oh, don't do this thing, don't do that thing. Are you aware that you're doing this other thing? Just that what that process is at its heart is like paring away everything that should not be there, and what you're left with is this beautiful performance.
Yeah.
And so that habit of mind was that's like how I lived for the prior 20 years.
Is your house very clean?
It's very clean. I mean, I'm lucky. I don't have to clean all of it. There's somebody that comes in a couple times a week and does the cleaning too. But, you know, my wife and I are very much aligned. And after babies go to bed, like, we're getting it back into shape. So you wake up in the morning and everything's where it needs to go. We don't like extra stuff.
Oh, man.
And so, you know, there's not a lot of extra stuff. And it's actually great for kids because, you know, our youngest is 2 years old, and he knows where the cars are. He knows where the trains are. He knows where the stuffed animals are, because there's one place for them to go, and that's where they go when they're not being used. But it's also, oh, I can't find this, I can't find that. It's like, okay, go look for it.
And, yeah, yeah.
You know, so it's good to know where things are supposed to be.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I don't know who said this, and I think it's not the most intelligent quote, but the whole idea that less is more. It seems to me that like less is actually less, because there's less to think about, which is simple. So it's almost like less is not more. Less is better or less, you know, I don't know if you'd fill in the blank with a different word, but I've always thought that word or that phrase is kind of interesting, because less is less distraction, less noise, and I agree. We have a 3-year-old and an 8-month-old,
and there's so much, like the infant industrial complex is telling you you need this thing or these strollers or that car seat, and it's like so much crap that you actually don't have to have. You don't have to fill your apartment with junk that's going to be unnecessary in 18 months.
Yeah, given away or donated or thrown. I mean, just the amount of volume. And it's interesting. We have my wife and I, we live in Seattle and love Seattle, love the density, love being 4 blocks from our office and our cafe. And
that's nice.
But we also have a piece of property in the middle of nowhere 3 hours away.
Oh, that's nice.
And our daughter, it's interesting because when we're there, our 3-year-old daughter, she has a few toys there, but when we're outside, she's either playing in the snow, she's playing with pine cones, she's playing with sticks, and this like creative side just comes out of her, and she doesn't need this, you know, Fisher Price thing that makes music and notes and all that. And so I'm very into the less is less.
Yeah, toys that make noise or have flashing lights, it's like it's when people give them to our kids, they'll be played with for a while, and then they'll mysteriously disappear.
Yeah, they'll just go away.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Hey, everyone. We will be back to my conversation with James Freeman in a moment. However, I wanted to share with you a story about using Mir's Pour Origami and Coffee Canister. If you have not heard about it, you should check it out on our website at mir.com/Kickstarter. Right now, we are offering exclusive rewards and pricing if you back the Mir Pour Origami and Coffee Canister before we ship them in August. As the founder and CEO of Mir, I get obviously access to products before they launch. And so on my flight from Seattle to Seoul to interview James and celebrate the opening of their new cafe in Korea, I used the Pour Origami at about 35,000 feet over the Pacific Ocean, and it was amazing. I had some funny looks, but ultimately, I had a delicious cup of coffee on the plane. So if you are a coffee geek and nerd like myself, this is a great portable flat pack dripper to make pour over anywhere in the world, from 35,000 feet over the Pacific Ocean to your campsite to your living room. I highly recommend it. So if you would like to be a part of these two new products, you can get exclusive pricing and discounts and packages at mir.com/Kickstarter. Now back to our conversation with James.
I'm curious by how you started the brand, and that you were saying in an interview that some your missteps almost became the path. And I'm fascinated by this because at Mir, you know, we found this path and we eventually got into bicycles, which sounds random, and it's a story for another day, and we exited that later on, but it became our path, and it actually developed some relationships with REI and Starbucks in a totally random way, but it's kind of beautiful way that happened. And I'm curious with you, what were some of those, you know, kind of quote unquote missteps or just, you know, things that you kind of stumbled into that you necessarily have a business plan to get into, but it actually worked out pretty well.
Yeah, I think just not caring that much about efficiency, not caring so much about how like cafes are supposed to be run, or even knowing how cafes are supposed to be run. I think those were really important things. Like really, I cared about how the coffee tasted, and then work backwards from there.
Yeah,
like, what do I have to do to make coffee taste good? And it's for me, it was make it like that, one cup at a time, or grind everything. You know, more coffee companies do this. It's quite common, but grind portions, one portion at a time in the espresso. You know, weigh things every time, measure things. Those were very inefficient steps and not very efficient ways to run a coffee company. But nobody, you know, I tell people now, nobody goes to their friend and says, "Oh my man, this new cafe just opened, and I hear their labor costs are 25%. Yes, let's go. I'm in. I'm buying." You know, so those things that seem so important when you're in business, it's like guests don't give a shit about that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what they care about is how it feels to be in the space, and is the front door clean, and is the coffee delicious, and does somebody remember their name if they're there a third or a fourth time?
Yeah, do they smile when they first greeted you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Those are important things.
Yeah.
And the other things, well, yes, eventually, you know, you have to have like numbers line up and stuff like that, but it's not why people go out for a coffee.
Yeah, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I feel like there's this duality between the inefficiencies and then excellence. You've talked a lot about scaling excellence and the hospitality,
I think I've talked more about scaling incompetence than scaling
excellence. Incompetence. Yeah. And there's this. It seems like sometimes people think scaling and quality are incongruent or can't match.
It can be.
And I found it almost the opposite with art. Is as we've grown and scaled, we have more kind of power to work with our suppliers of implementing quality standards and QC and QA. And have you found that to be similar?
Yeah, especially with vendor, like more people want to work with you, more people are willing to listen to interesting / crazy ideas, more people can interact with you in a way that can make things better. So it can be the case that as one grows, you get more interesting opportunities and opportunities to improve.
I think this idea that challenging the status quo, not just challenging it for the sake of challenging it, but you know, anytime we innovate on a product or come up with a new idea, and we go to the factory and they say, "Oh, it's not possible," it actually motivates me even more in a sense that people get in these routines and habits of just doing the same thing,
right,
of kind of maintaining status quo. And I think you've been asked before, how do you maintain? And you're
you got to improve. That's a trigger word for me. Maintain.
Yeah. So how have you not maintained, but how have you grown and improved while scaling to Japan and ultimately Korea?
Well, I mean, I think opening in Japan has pushed us to be better in so many ways. In many senses, the best Blue Bottle coffee can be is Blue Bottle coffee in Japan. Mm. Just in terms of the finish of the stores, the design of the stores, the construction standards, the quality standards of staff, the cleanliness standards, the hospitality standards, the way that Saki Egawa, our head of Asia, or I forget what her title is, but the way she built the Japanese team, you know, laid the foundation for the best that Blue Bottle could be, and that happens to be in Japan. Hopefully it will be met or exceeded by Blue Bottle Korea. So every time we open in a new market, I think it's pushed us to improve, and the lessons learned in the new market, some of, not all of them unfortunately, but many of them we've been able to apply in our American market. I mean, there's some institutional constraints. I was talking to a friend, or a colleague here, and it's like, oh man, I've got to go back to Oakland in a few days and see like these sneeze guards around the drip bar, and I'm just going to want to like shoot myself. You know, they're very silly constraints, regulatory constraints around how you can build certain things in the United States that are so freeing. Mm. Here in Korea and in Japan, especially around sneeze guards. I was at this cafe yesterday, beautiful, beautiful cafe down the street called Onion. Just like this gloriously crumbled building that they've inserted these patios and like beautiful little moments. And I loved it. And God, it's like I would go to sneeze guard jail if I tried to do that. Like there's so many things that couldn't be allowable in the United States. And to be fair, if I had my 2-year-old there, I would not be relaxed at all because he could plummet to his death at any moment at this cafe. But it was beautiful and just kind of freeing to see somebody able to build a cafe like that.
Well, I mean, even these stairs that we're looking at, I am fascinated by the stadium, but they're, you know, in America, these are too tall of stairs. There's no handrail.
Yeah.
There's no bumps or guard or whatever.
Yet and nobody's died.
And yet, everyone's walking up and down them just fine, and it's a beautiful space.
Yeah. It's so funny. Like, there's such duality of regulatory environments between the built environment in the United States and then the sort of the other environments, which are more important, like that govern people's financial lives, that are far less regulated.
Yeah. There's a duality and a hypocrisy.
Totally.
I want to touch on Japan for a little bit. Mm. Japan's magical.
It's an inspiring place.
We started working there about 4 years ago, and I'm just fascinated by their attention to detail, the politeness, their gun safety. I was talking to my head of ops today, and he was saying that in 2016 there were like 38,000 gun incidents in the U.S. In Japan there were 6.
Right.
Which is a whole other issue. But what was the move to Japan? What was that like for you? For us it was this attention. Like we felt like we were at home in a sense of simple, clean design. Mm. Like we were like, oh, we get each other. You know, was that similar?
Oh yeah. I went there as a teenager with a musical group and I had that was the first time I'd left the country, I think, except for as a 2-year-old. So it was a very indelible experience. Then I went back after I started Blue Bottle Coffee and there's that, just that sense of kinship. It's, you know, seeing somebody, I went to a bunch of Kisetens one day and seeing, you know, this incredible virtuosity, this quiet virtuosity, the thoughtfulness about how certain elements line up, the willingness to be inefficient in a way that's in service of a better experience. Mm. All of those things first of all, made me feel like a rookie. You know, this was 2008. I thought I knew a little bit about coffee and service. And I was like, wow, I'm a beginner. And then second of all, I felt like, oh, these people get me in this very deep way that I never felt in the United States. So it's not a perfect society. It sucks to be a woman in the workforce. You know, there's a lot of economic constraints on society, the disinclination to allow foreigners to immigrate has led to an economy of dwindling consumers. So it's not perfect by any means. However, you know, is my child less likely to die in a school shooting? That is true. There are fewer people starving in the streets. If somebody's sick, they can go to a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
There are many, many inspiring things about that society.
Absolutely. I love Japan. I also love Korea. We're here in Korea. What was you know, going to Japan and then Korea? I mean, for people who don't know, Korea almost has the same amount of coffee shops as the U.S. It's fascinating. There's a coffee shop on every corner.
Yeah.
They get coffee. Especially coffee is a newer idea here, though.
Right, yeah. But the idea of being served well in a cafe that has a certain attentiveness to the look and feel and hospitality is not new.
No,
it's something that's very, very highly evolved.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by that, especially in the U.S. You know, there's this idea that you have to pay more for good service in the U.S., and that's what's so refreshing in Japan and Korea is you could go to a 7-Eleven or a very inexpensive ramen shop, and it's great service.
Right. The pride and professionalism, I think, across many of the sectors of different industries that I've come up with is that's one of the most inspiring things.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you see Blue Bottle continuing its Asian expansion?
I think that's the place where we tend to be at our best and where the more people are interested in what we do, so why not?
Yeah,
I was talking to a colleague that I think there's going to be a moment in the not too distant future where Blue Bottle Asia revenues exceed Blue Bottle U.S. revenues.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. The receptiveness of Mir into the Asian culture has been astounding for us.
That's great.
And it's been fun. You know, it's I love travel, and it's been a great way to get to Hong Kong and to China and Korea and Taiwan and Japan. And it's fun. And the Taiwan, you had a Taiwan pop-up?
Yes, I didn't go to it. That was Saki's doing, but it was very, very successful. So I think we sold a lot of your cups.
We did.
Yeah.
We did sell a lot of cups.
Sold a lot of other things,
too. And it was mostly merch, right?
We imported the black coffee cans,
yep,
and those flew off the shelves, too.
Yeah.
So, and they were, you know, all the costs of importing, they were not cheap.
Yeah, oh, man.
So, so that led us think that, oh, maybe Taiwan's a good,
oh, interesting,
good place for us.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to touch a little bit on, you know, it's been a wild journey for you with multiple investors and newer owners.
Mm.
How do you? I'm curious about this. We have a handful of friends and family at Mir, and while we scale, I feel as though I am often making the case for the illogical, because sometimes the illogical becomes commercial in a weird roundabout way.
Mm.
How do you do that these days? How do you make that case for slow coffee or things that might not on paper in a boardroom make sense?
Yeah, I think the days of me really pushing that are behind me. So there's this phrase from my undergraduate, the normative power of the actual, you know, and like once you see something in place, it's like, okay, I get that. And so that was the whole Nestle thing. It's like, all right, they walk into a store, they see it filled with people, they see people making coffee in a very slow and inefficient yet beautiful way, and they saw the value in that.
Yeah.
So that's and then going forward, it's, you know, they're smart, they don't want to ruin what we've got, and they're not as strong in what's called out of home coffee, which means cafes, so they want to let us try to lead that. So
yeah,
that's where my thinking is around that.
So you mentioned that you're kind of beyond that in this stage. There's a beautiful word, I'm totally going to butcher it, co-terroir, basically the imprint of the founder or maestro. Do you remember that word?
I don't know.
I listened to an interview and you said this word of like co-terroir, and this idea that there's this imprint of the founder that lasts when you have a certain perspective. Mm. And I'm curious, what imprint do you look around in this cafe in Korea, or just in Blue Bottle in general, now that it's global and that you, you're in the stage where you can look back and go, ah, that was an imprint of James.
Yeah, I look around. I mean, I was talking to a colleague yesterday, and it's like, oh, I wasn't on purpose, but there's basically now 1,000 people across the company that dress like I do. the chambray army.
there's a chambray army here.
Yeah. There are these funny little ticks, funny little things that have become embedded in the way people think about Blue Bottle that are, you know, little personal quirks of mine that have become institutionalized. They're nice personal quirks. You know, having a nice stereo in a shop is important. Having a, you know, a uniform that kind of blends into the surroundings is important. The colors of Blue Bottle Coffee, obviously they start with that bottle, 2995C.
it's a great
but those
Pantone.
Those are, yeah, it is. But those are the colors of San Francisco, really, the blues and grays, the blue sky and the ocean at certain times, the grays, the moody, the fog coming in. You know, it's like that's a San Francisco palette that we have, you know, now in Korea and Tokyo and Kobe and across the United States. Not across, but on the coasts of the United States.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting to think about the significance of certain little objects, how they came from, you know, these very personal decisions and now are kind of enshrined in this institutional way in the company without intending it to be so.
And it's all kind of come together in this beautiful way.
Yeah, and learning from different architects, their strengths, their weaknesses, you know, what is important in design. What makes people feel a certain way, where you can go wrong. It's very easy to go wrong.
Mm. Do you, in the last, the Blue Bottle is what, 16 years old now?
2002, yeah.
So a little over 16 years. I love, we started in 2010, quit my day job in 2009, and people are like, oh, you guys are an overnight success.
right. Yeah, we were being called a startup a couple of years ago.
Yeah, you're like, it's been a while.
A very old startup.
Do you have any, looking back, what are some of your fondest moments in the last 16 years of this incredible journey?
The Tokyo opening was very exciting, very exhilarating. I have to say that. Just like the old, having the cart at the farmer's market, seeing people, you know, bumping into people that I used to serve at the farmer's market or seeing people. It's like, oh, that was a soy cappuccino. I don't remember that dude's name, but I remember making him soy cappuccinos. All the stories, all the conversations. But yeah, there's a few moments, like these moments that kind of signaled the end of a chapter or the beginning of a new chapter that I think about.
Have your passions changed over these 16 years?
Yeah, I think as we've brought more cafes into the world, I think I've been wanting very deeply to push how people feel when we're in the cafes and push the design of the cafes. So just, you know, it might seem simpler or innocuous. There's a piece of equipment. It's an Akaya bean counter is what they're called. Mm. They're behind the bar.
Yep.
And then there's a Melkonig EK43. Next to it, and I've been wanting to see that in our shops for like 2 years. It's a way the Melkonig EK43 is a very high quality grinder, and so when you're taking an order and you have multiple coffees on the menu, you know, the problem is how do we grind this coffee to order and serve it in a way that approximates some sort of efficiency. The way we've done it in the United States has been troubling me for a while because there's certain home grinders, I won't call out the company, certain home grinders that we have on the bar, grind quality is not as good as this EK43, and they break all the time. And I've been wanting to see these Akaya bean counters because they're very, press a button, they just, you know, 23 grams of coffee goes in, it's very accurate. You put it through the EK43, very high quality, boom, boom. Finally, it's here. It's not happening in the United States, and that makes me frustrated, but that's the kind of nice thing about expanding, is that more things are possible the farther away we get from Oakland. There's a Chinese proverb I think about, and it's, the mountains are high and the emperor is far away. And so we can do things as we get farther away from HQ that might not be tolerated in Oakland. So it's freeing, it's liberating to see the borders being pushed.
Interesting. How do you think Korea will influence Blue Bottle?
Hopefully it's, you know, it's going to be similar, like the hospitality culture, the service culture, and I think we're going to learn things from the Korean team. The nice thing is there's a lot of Japan team has come over, and so that's creating this interesting cocktail of influences. And so whatever, I don't know what we're going to learn from Korea, but I know we will learn some things, and then how we apply what we've learned to new cafes, new contexts, that's going to be the exciting thing.
Interesting. Well, I'm curious, as we wrap up, my wife developed, we usually do this podcast together.
Oh, that's nice.
She's with the kids at home. She missed out on this trip.
How many do you have? You have a three-year-old?
Yeah, three-year-old and 9-month-old.
Oh, that's a handful.
Yeah, a handful. We're going to attempt to bring one of them to Europe this summer for a coffee trade show, and we have some partners in Scandinavia. So,
oh, that's nice.
Part of the secret reason to start my own company was to be able to travel the world.
Mm-hmm.
We do a bit in the outdoor space, but coffee for us has been beautiful because coffee's global.
Yeah.
You know, we work with partners in Saudi Arabia and Europe and Japan and Korea, obviously, and China. And so it's been a great way for us to be able to travel. And I'm looking forward to taking our kids around the world with us, which would be fun. But she developed a bunch of great questions at the end, fairly simple. And, you know, there's an African proverb about, you know, if you want to go far, go alone. If you want to go, or if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together.
That's good.
So is it easier to go alone or together?
Easier in what sense?
Up to you.
With the babies, it's everything is like a project. It's like invading a small nation because you have to have like your logistics correctly, and you have like frame of mind, and it's serious, and
snacks and diapers
and that's it's important, it's beautiful, it's lovely, and when we do travel with the babies, they've both been to Japan, you know, there's always these like real distinct developmental leaps that happen when they travel. But you know, traveling by yourself is super easy. You know you might think jet lag's a problem or whatever, but if you've got a couple toddlers at home, you know, it's like, this is cake.
Totally.
So I haven't been traveling a lot this year, and so of course I miss everybody at home, but this is pretty easy, and you know, and my schedule's pretty tight, and it's like, you know, wall to wall, and with the family along, I just have to build in a lot more more time.
Yeah, time to hang out and naps and food and
and just time to be with them.
Yeah, hang out and enjoy. What is one belief that you hold on to that will never change?
I don't think you can say. I think the universe is more complicated than anything you can say about it. So, you know, I think certainty is a very unattractive quality. So I can't say that there will be anything that I have an opinion of now that I won't reject at some future time.
Maybe clutter.
Oh, perhaps.
I don't see you embracing clutter in the future.
Perhaps that's where I must draw the line.
Is there an activity you turn to when you need some headspace to be able to think, not necessarily reset, but just to be able to have a clarity of mind? Is there something you turn to? Music? Is it exercise?
Yeah. I mean, I do like listening to music. My teenager gave me these headphones, these Bluetooth headphones that somehow I'd been rejecting, but man, it's great in the back of a taxi when you're sort of grinding through traffic to just listen to the music that you choose to listen to rather than the taxi driver might choose to listen to. So that listening, and then exercising, very important to me. So just like in terms of getting my mind straight. So even if I have to set the alarm, like I did today, and get up a little early, go up to the hotel gymnasium.
Yeah. Is there a workout of choice?
I will do that. What was that?
Is there a workout of choice for you? Like, what do you enjoy? Rowing, running?
I've been taking Thai boxing lessons for the last year and a half. And my teacher, Jong Sanon, is very patient teacher, and that sometimes, you know, it's been surprising to me, but to punch and kick and yell is actually really great, and there's very few contexts in our world where those are acceptable things to do.
Yeah,
and that's been very good to me, for me. And then I do in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, I do these boot camp workouts.
Yeah.
So you don't actually have to wear boots.
Yeah.
And the trainers there are very patient, and it's always like very beautiful surroundings. The gymnasium, working out indoors is not my first choice, but I do it because I know I'll feel better afterwards. It's not exactly inspiring like running around Golden Gate Park.
One of our great board members, Lisa Picard, has recommended getting into Aikido. Have you heard of this?
Sure.
Japanese martial art?
Yeah.
She was saying that it's one of the only martial arts where part of the defense is also protecting your attacker, or is the only one. So instead of just protecting yourself and disarming the person who might be attacking you, while you're doing the maneuvers, you're also trying to protect them from themselves, which to me, philosophically, like, was a total mind cluster. I was like, this is interesting. So I think I'm going to try that one of these days.
Yeah. I think everybody has, like, some activity that feels natural to them, and the process is just finding it.
Yeah. Yep. Do you work out alone mostly?
No.
Or your wife?
I not usually. I mean, I have these classes that I go to in Golden Gate Park, and it's the same kind of cast of characters. I call it senior CrossFit.
That's awesome.
And then, obviously in the boxing lesson, I've got my boxing teacher, and it's good to, like, when you're, like, actually being, like, hit, that like, sort of gets the seriousness of the endeavor more embedded, deeply embedded in your body, actually.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, that'd be like dropping kettlebells on yourself, too.
Yeah.
Gets you focused.
But nobody's throwing kettlebells at
you. Yeah, definitely.
You have to protect yourself from the kettlebells.
Yeah. Fill in the blank. John. So, I don't know if you know this, but Muir is named after John Muir. It's a tip of the cap to John Muir, M-U-I-R.
Oh, I see.
And John Muir helped develop the National Park System and John Muir Trail and yada, yada. From California, you obviously know this. So, he was obviously saying, the mountains are calling and I must go. So, fill in the blank is calling and I must go. What is your blank?
My toddler right now. I was just talking to him on the phone. I mean, I don't consider, even in spite of this, talking about the Golden Gate Park, I don't consider myself a very outdoorsy person. The idea of camping or backpacking makes me worried in terms of the range of discomforts that I might experience. But, however, having said that, we're actually leaving, my family and I are actually leaving San Francisco in a few months and moving to my wife's hometown in Ojai,
California. Oh, yeah, beautiful. Yeah.
And it's very beautiful. So just the land and the mountains of Ojai, I kind of feel every time my daughter points out a human poop on the sidewalks of San Francisco, I feel the mountains of Ojai calling.
Oh yeah, Ojai is beautiful. Ventura. We visit Ventura quite often because Patagonia's headquarters
are
there.
Yeah.
I just love it down there when we go to visit with them and to get in the ocean. I'm deathly afraid of sharks, and yet I force myself to go surfing with our buyers down there. It's a very uncomfortable experience.
Yeah,
faceless fear. So.
So far, so good.
So far, so good. I've heard it's, you're more likely to be struck by lightning or something. So I think the odds are good. But
Or mowed down by a vigilante in a shopping mall.
Yeah, something awful like that. So I'll take my chances with sharks. At Mir, we talk a lot about empowering others. Our podcast is called the Empowerful Podcast. So we made up this word empowerful, which is kind of empower plus all the great words that end in grateful. Grateful, thankful, beautiful. I'm wondering in your words, what empowerful might mean to you and to Blue Bottle?
Oof. That's a little bit of a tricky issue with me because I don't like it when people make up words. anytime some MBA who works for Blue Bottle puts an S on the word learning and uses it as a noun, I think there are plenty of words in the English language that already exist to serve those purposes.
Well, then let me put it down this way.
How, very good.
Let's just go with empower. What does empower mean to you and to Blue Bottle?
Oh, that I can happily talk to and about, you know, that the word empower, just like seeing Saki walk around and, you know, she's running Asia and doing it very capably. And, you know, she came into Blue Bottle Japan as head of PR or something like that, but she was given opportunities and did every, you know, took advantage of every opportunity that she was given and did an excellent job. And our head of QC for Blue Bottle Japan, now Blue Bottle Asia, this guy Kevin, who was a wholesale trainer, went back when we did wholesale in Oakland, moved to Tokyo, and now he's, you know, visiting Myanmar and buying coffee for us. And so just seeing people succeed and grow and feel challenged and satisfied in their work here at Blue Bottle and knowing, like, in a few years their lives could be very different, but still here. Another colleague, Rio.
I love Rio.
Yeah, I mean, he used to work at a bank.
Yeah.
You know, and he was telling me, I was looking at pictures of the space and talking about the lighting, because the lighting's tricky. Lighting's tricky in any space, but especially in a semi-subterranean space like this that can be quite austere looking. It's like, oh, is this a prison for lattes? You know, you know, the lighting is very tricky, and I was talking about the downlighting and how that like makes a big difference in your perception of the space and enjoyment of the space. And he's like, oh yeah, I spent 6 hours with, you know, the construction team on like getting this lighting exactly the way I want. It's like, they didn't teach you that at Mitsui Bank, you know? So he's discovering that he has this very creative part of him, and part of his enjoyment of his work is the creativity in creating a space that's very special, and the fact that that's inside him and he didn't realize that. You know, that the way of looking at a space and being very creative about how people might feel, he didn't think he had that in him, but it's been demonstrated that he does, and it's nice to see that.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Seeing your colleagues rise and challenge themselves. Yeah. That's probably one of my favorite moments about being a founder is being able to see people grow with you in the company and rise to the occasion and develop skills they didn't even know they had.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, this has been a pleasure to sit down and talk with you. Congrats on the expansion into Korea.
Thank you very much.
It's good to be here with you.
Thanks for the cup.
You're absolutely welcome. I'm excited to try some of your coffee in Korea for the first time.
Great, yeah.
For those listening, you can check out bluebottle.com,
bluebottlecoffee.com
for subscription coffee, which is fantastic. You have single origins and blends, and it's a beautiful experience. You can also grab coffee at their cafes in New York, L.A., San Francisco, Oakland, San Diego's in.
Yep.
Tokyo, Kyoto, Kobe, Seoul, and the list goes on. So congrats again. It's great to be a partner with you. Thank you for all that you've done. It's exciting to be a partner with you. And we get to do good in the world together. So I'm excited to give kids clean water in schools in Ethiopia with our support together. So thank you.
Amazing. Thanks. Yeah. Nice chatting. Yep.
Thanks for tuning in. We will see you on the next episode.